However, I believe she's going on this Nile trip too, and I expect we'll have to be more or less all matey together, shan't we?
It is a possible contingency, madame.
I'm very matey, really. People interest me enormously. All the different types. She paused, and then said, Tim tells me that that dark girl, her name is de Belfort, is the girl who was engaged to Simon Doyle. It's rather awkward for them, meeting like this.
It is awkward, yes,
agreed Poirot. Mrs. Allerton shot a quick glance at him.
You know, it may sound foolish, but she almost frightened me. She looked so intense.
Poirot nodded his head slowly.
You are not far wrong, madame. A great force of emotion is always frightening.
Do people interest you too, Monsieur Poirot, or do you reserve your interest for potential criminals?
Madame, that category would not leave many people outside it.
Mrs. Allerton looked a trifle startled.
Do you really mean that?
Well, given the particular incentive, that is to say,
Poirot added.
Which would differ, or naturally?
Mrs. Allerton hesitated, a little smile on her lips.
Even I, perhaps?
Mothers, madame, are particularly ruthless when their children are in danger.
She said gravely, I think that's true. Yes, you're quite right.
She was silent a minute or two. Then she said, smiling,
I'm trying to imagine motives for crime suitable for everyone in the hotel. It's quite entertaining. Simon Doyle, for instance.
Poirot said, smiling,
A very simple crime. A direct shortcut to his objective. No subtlety about it.
And therefore very easily detected?
Yes.
He would not be ingenious. And Lynette? That would be like the queen in your Alice in Wonderland. Off with her head.
Oh, of course. The divine right of monarchy. Just a little bit of the Naboth's vineyard touch.
And the dangerous girl, Jacqueline de Belfort, could she do a murder?
Poirot hesitated for a minute or two. Then he said doubtfully,
Yes, I think she could.
But you're not sure?
No. She pulses me, that little one.
I don't think Mr. Pennington could do one, do you? He looks so desiccated and dyspeptic, with no red blood in him.
But possibly a strong sense of self-preservation.
Yes, I suppose so. And poor Mrs. Otterbourne in her turban?
Well, there is always vanity.
What has a motive for murder?
Mrs. Allerton asked doubtfully.
Motives for murder are sometimes very trivial, madame.
What are the most usual motives, Monsieur Poirot?
Most frequent? Money. That is to say, gain in its various ramifications. Then there is revenge, and love, and fear, and pure hate, and beneficence.
Monsieur Poirot!
Oh, yes, madame. I have known of, shall we say, A, being removed by B, solely in order to benefit C. Political murders often come under that heading. Someone is considered to be harmful to civilization and is removed on that account. Such people forget that life and death are the affair of the good God.
He spoke gravely. Mrs. Allerton said quickly, I'm glad to hear you say that. All the same, God chooses his instruments.
There is a danger in thinking like that, madame.
She adopted a lighter tone.
After this conversation, Monsieur Poirot, I shall wonder that there is anyone left alive.
She got up.
We must be getting back. We have to start immediately after lunch.
When they reached the landing stage, they found the young man in the polo jumper just taking his place in the boat. The Italian was already waiting. As the Nubian boatman cast the sail loose and they started, Poirot addressed a polite remark to the stranger.
There are very wonderful things to be seen in Egypt, are there not?
The young man was now smoking a somewhat noisome pipe. He removed it from his mouth and remarked briefly and emphatically in astonishingly well-bred accents.
They make me sick.
Mrs. Allerton put on her pince-nez and surveyed him with pleasurable interest. Poirot said,
Indeed? And why is that?
Take the pyramids. Great blocks of useless masonry. Put up to minister to the egoism of a despotic, bloated king. Think of the sweated masses who toiled to build them and died doing it. It makes me sick to think of the suffering and torture they represent.
Mrs. Allerton said cheerfully,
You'd rather have no pyramids, no Parthenon, no beautiful tombs or temples? Just the solid satisfaction of knowing that people got three meals a day and died in their beds?
The young man directed his scowl in her direction.
I think human beings matter more than stones.
But they do not endure as well,
remarked Hercule Poirot.
Well, I'd rather see a well-fed worker than any so-called work of art. What matters is the future, not the past.
This was too much for Signor Ricchetti, who burst into a torrent of impassioned speech, not easy to follow. The young man retorted by telling everybody exactly what he thought of the capitalist system. He spoke with the utmost venom. When the tirade was over, they had arrived at the hotel landing stage. Mrs. Allerton murmured cheerfully, "Well, well," and stepped ashore. The young man directed a baleful glance after her. In the hall of the hotel, Poirot encountered Jacqueline de Belfort. She was dressed in riding clothes. She gave him an ironical little bow.
"I'm going donkey riding. Do you recommend the native villages, Monsieur Poirot?"
"Is that your excursion today, mademoiselle? Eh bien, they are picturesque, but do not spend large sums on native curios."
"Well, which are shipped here from Europe?"
"No, I'm not so easy to deceive as that."
With a little nod, she passed out into the brilliant sunshine. Poirot completed his packing. A very simple affair, since his possessions were always in the most meticulous order. Then he repaired to the dining room and ate an early lunch. After lunch, the hotel bus took the passengers for the second cataract to the station where they were to catch the daily express from Cairo on to Shellal, a 10 minutes' run. The Allertons, Poirot, the young man in the dirty flannel trousers, and the Italian were the passengers. Mrs. Otterbourne and her daughter had made the expedition to the dam and to Philae, and would join the steamer at Shellal. The train from Cairo and Luxor was about 20 minutes late. However, it arrived at last, and the usual scenes of wild activity occurred. Native porters taking suitcases out of the train collided with other porters putting them in. Finally, somewhat breathless, Poirot found himself with an assortment of his own, the Allertons and some totally unknown luggage, in one compartment while Tim and his mother were elsewhere with the remains of the assorted baggage. The compartment in which Poirot found himself was occupied by an elderly lady with a very wrinkled face, a stiff white stock, a good many diamonds, and an expression of reptilian contempt for the majority of mankind. She treated Poirot to an aristocratic glare and retired behind the pages of an American magazine. A big, rather clumsy young woman of under 30 was sitting opposite her. She had eager brown eyes, rather like a dog's, untidy hair, and a terrific air of willingness to please. At intervals, the old lady looked over the top of her magazine and snapped out an order.
"Cornelia, collect the rugs. When we arrive, look after my dressing case. On no account let anyone else handle it, and don't forget my paper cutter."
The train run was brief. In 10 minutes' time, they came to rest on the jetty where the SS Carnac was awaiting them. The Otterbournes were already on board. The Carnac was a smaller steamer than the Papyrus and the Lotus, the first cataract steamers which are too large to pass through the locks of the Aswan Dam. The passengers went on board and were shown their accommodation. Since the boat was not full, most of the passengers had cabins on the promenade deck. The entire forward part of this deck was occupied by an observation saloon, all glass enclosed, where the passengers could sit and watch the river unfold before them. On the deck below was a smoking room and small drawing room, and on the deck below that, the dining saloon. Having seen his possessions disposed in his cabin, Poirot came out on deck again to watch the process of departure. He joined Rosalie Otterbourne, who was leaning over the side.
"So, now we journey into Nubia. You are pleased, mademoiselle?"
The girl drew a deep breath.
"Yes, I feel that one's really getting away from things at last."
She made a gesture with her hand. There was a savage aspect about the sheet of water in front of them, the masses of rock without vegetation that came down to the water's edge. Here and there a trace of houses, abandoned and ruined as a result of the damming up of the waters. The whole scene had a melancholy, almost sinister charm.
"Away from people,"
said Rosalie Otterbourne.
"Except those of your own number, mademoiselle?"
She shrugged her shoulders, and then she said,
"Oh, there's something about this country that makes me feel wicked.
It brings to the surface all the things that are boiling inside one. Everything so unfair, so unjust."
"I wonder. You cannot judge by material evidence,"
Rosalie muttered.
"Well, look at some people's mothers, and look at mine. There is no god but sex, and Salome Otterbourne is its prophet."
She stopped.
"I shouldn't have said that, I suppose."
Poirot made a gesture with his hands.
"Why not say it to me? I am one of those who hear many things. If, as you say, you boil inside, like the jam, eh bien, let the scum come to the surface, and then one can take it off with a spoon, so.
He made the gesture of dropping something into the Nile.
There, it has gone.
Rosalie said,
"What an extraordinary man you are."
Her sulky mouth twisted into a smile. Then she suddenly stiffened as she exclaimed,
"Why, here are Mrs. Doyle and her husband. I'd no idea they were coming on this trip."
Lynette had just emerged from a cabin halfway along the deck. Simon was behind her. Poirot was almost startled by the look of her, so radiant, so assured. She looked positively arrogant with happiness. Simon Doyle, too, was a transformed being. He was grinning from ear to ear and looking like a happy schoolboy.
"Oh, this is grand," he said,
as he too leaned on the rail. "I'm really looking forward to this trip, aren't you, Lynette? It feels somehow so much less touristy, as though we were really going into the heart of Egypt." His wife responded quickly.
"I know. It's so much wilder, somehow."
Her hand slipped through his arm. He pressed it close to his side.
"We're off, Lynn," he murmured.
The steamer was drawing away from the jetty. They had started on their 7 days' journey to the second cataract and back. Behind them, a light silvery laugh rang out. Lynette whipped round. Jacqueline de Belfort was standing there. She seemed amused.
"Hello, Lynette. I didn't expect to find you here. I thought you said you were staying at Aswan another 10 days. This is a surprise."
You didn't..."
Lynette's tongue stammered. She forced a ghastly conventional smile.
"I didn't expect to see you either." "No?"
Jacqueline moved away to the other side of the boat. Lynette's grasp on her husband's arm tightened.
"Simon! Simon!"
All Doyle's good-natured pleasure had gone. He looked furious. His hands clenched themselves in spite of his effort at self-control. The two of them moved a little away. Without turning his head, Poirot caught scraps of disjointed words.
"Turn back? Impossible.
But we could." And then slightly louder, Doyle's voice, despairing but grim.
"We can't run away forever, Lynn. We've got to go through with it now."
It was some hours later. Daylight was just fading. Poirot stood in the glass-enclosed saloon looking straight ahead. The Karnak was going through a narrow gorge. The rocks came down with a kind of sheer ferocity to the river flowing deep and swift between them. They were in Nubia now. He heard a movement, and Lynette Doyle stood by his side. Her fingers twisted and untwisted themselves. She looked as he had never yet seen her look. There was about her the air of a bewildered child. She said,
"Monsieur Poirot, I'm afraid of everything. I've never felt like this before. All these wild rocks, and the awful grimness and starkness. Where are we going? What's going to happen? I'm afraid, I tell you. Everyone hates me. I've never felt like that before. I've always been nice to people. I've done things for them, and they hate me. Lots of people hate me. Well, except for Simon. I'm surrounded by enemies. It's terrible to feel that there are people who hate you."
"Oh, but what is all this, madame?"
She shook her head.
"I suppose... oh, it's nerves. I just feel that everything's unsafe all around me."
She cast a quick, nervous glance over her shoulder. Then she said abruptly,
"How will all this end? We're caught here. Trapped. There's no way out. We've got to go on. I don't know where I am."
She slipped down onto a seat. Poirot looked down on her gravely. His glance was not untinged with compassion. She said,
"How did she know we were coming on this boat? How could she have known?"
Poirot shook his head as he answered,
"She has brains, you know."
"I feel as though I shall never escape from her."
Poirot said,
"There is one plan you might have adopted. In fact, I am surprised that it did not occur to you. After all, with you, madame, money is no object. Why did you not engage your own private dahabiya?"
Lynette shook her head rather helplessly.
"Look, if we'd known about all this, but you see we didn't then, and it was difficult..."
She flashed out with sudden impatience.
"Oh, you don't understand half my difficulties. I've got to be careful with Simon. He's absurdly sensitive, about money, about my having so much. He wanted me to go to some little place in Spain with him. He wanted to pay all our honeymoon expenses himself. As if it mattered. Men are stupid. He's got to get used to living comfortably. The mere idea of a dahabiyah upset him. The needless expense. I've got to educate him gradually.
She looked up, bit her lip vexedly, as though feeling that she had been led into discussing her difficulties rather too unguardedly. She got up.
I must change. I am sorry, Monsieur Poirot. I'm afraid I've been talking a lot of foolish nonsense.
Chapter 8. Mrs. Allerton, looking quiet and distinguished in her simple black lace evening gown, descended two decks to the dining room. At the door of it, her son caught her up.
Oh, sorry, darling. I thought I was going to be late. I wonder where we sit.
The saloon was dotted with little tables. Mrs. Allerton paused till the steward, who was busy seating a party of people, could attend to them.
Oh, by the way, she added, I asked little Hercule Poirot to sit at our table.
Mother, you didn't!
Tim sounded really taken aback and annoyed.
His mother stared at him in surprise. Tim was usually so easygoing.
My dear, do you mind?
Yes, I do. He's an unmitigated little bounder.
Oh, no, Tim. I don't agree with you.
Anyway, what do we want to get mixed up with an outsider for? Cooped up like this on a small boat, that sort of thing, is always a bore. He'll be with us morning, noon and night.
Well, I'm sorry, dear. Mrs. Allerton looked distressed. I thought really it would amuse you. After all, he must have had a varied experience, and you love detective stories.
Tim grunted.
I wish you wouldn't have these bright ideas, Mother. Well, we can't get out of it now, I suppose. Well, really, Tim, I don't see how we can.
Oh, well, we shall have to put up with it, I suppose. The steward came to them at this minute and led them to a table. Mrs. Allerton's face wore rather a puzzled expression as she followed him. Tim was usually so easygoing and good-tempered. This outburst was quite unlike him. It wasn't as though he had the ordinary British's dislike and mistrust of foreigners. Tim was very cosmopolitan. Oh, well, she sighed. Men were incomprehensible. Even one's nearest and dearest had unsuspected reactions and feelings. As they took their places, Hercule Poirot came quickly and silently into the dining saloon. He paused with his hand on the back of the third chair.
You really permit, madame, that I avail myself of your kind suggestion?
Of course. Sit down, Monsieur Poirot.
You are most amiable.
She was uneasily conscious that, as he seated himself, he shot a swift glance at Tim, and that Tim had not quite succeeded in masking a somewhat sullen expression. Mrs. Allerton set herself to produce a pleasant atmosphere. As they drank their soup, she picked up the passenger list, which had been placed beside her plate.
"Let's try and identify everybody," she said cheerfully. "I always think that's rather fun."
She began reading.
"Mrs. Allerton and Mr. T. Allerton."
"That's easy enough.
Miss de Belfort. Now, they've put her at the same table as the Otterbournes, I see. I wonder what she and Rosalie will make of each other. Well, who comes next?"
"Dr. Besner."
"Dr. Besner. Now, who can identify Dr. Besner?"
She bent her glance on a table at which four men sat together.
"I think he must be the fat one with the closely shaved head and the moustache. A German, I should imagine. He seems to be enjoying his soup very much."
Certain succulent noises floated across to them. Mrs. Allerton continued.
"Miss Bowers. Can we make a guess at Miss Bowers? Now, there are three or four women. No, we'll leave her for the present. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Doyle? Oh, yes, indeed, the lions of this trip. She really is very beautiful, and what a perfectly lovely frock she's wearing."
Tim turned round in his chair. Lynette and her husband and Andrew Pennington had been given a table in the corner. Lynette was wearing a white dress and pearls.
"It looks frightfully simple to me," said Tim. "Just a length of stuff with a kind of cord round the middle."
"Yes, darling," said his mother.
"A very nice manly description of an 80-guinea model."
Tim said, "I can't think why women pay so much for their clothes. It seems absurd to me."
Mrs. Allerton proceeded with her study of her fellow passengers.
"Mr. Fanthorpe must be the intensely quiet young man who never speaks at the same table as the German. Rather a nice face, cautious,
but intelligent. Poirot agreed.
He is intelligent, yes. He does not talk, but he listens very attentively, and he also watches. Yes. He makes good use of his eyes. Not quite the type you'd expect to find travelling for pleasure in this part of the world. I wonder what he is doing here.
Mr. Ferguson, read Mrs. Allerton. I feel that Ferguson must be our anti-capitalist friend.
Mrs. Otterbourne? Miss Otterbourne.
Well, we know all about them.
Mr. Pennington, alias Uncle Andrew. He's a good-looking man, I think.
Now, Mother, said Tim.
No, I think he's very good-looking in a dry sort of way, said Mrs. Allerton. Rather a ruthless jaw. Probably the kind of man one reads about in the paper, who operates on Wall Street. Or is it in Wall Street? I'm sure he must be extremely rich. Next?
Ah, Monsieur Hercule Poirot.
Whose talents are really being wasted.
Can't you get up a crime for Monsieur Poirot, Tim?
But her well-meant banter only seemed to annoy her son anew. He scowled, and Mrs. Allerton hurried on.
Mr. Ricchetti, our Italian archaeological friend, then Miss Robson, and last of all, Miss Van Schuyler.
Oh, the last's easy. The very ugly old American lady who obviously feels herself the queen of the boat and who is clearly going to be very exclusive and speak to nobody who doesn't come up to the most exacting standards.
She's rather marvellous, isn't she, really? A kind of period piece. Now, the two women with her must be Miss Bowers and Miss Robson.
Well, perhaps her secretary.
The thin one with pince-nez. And a poor relation. The rather pathetic young woman who is obviously enjoying herself in spite of being treated like a black slave. I think Robson's the secretary woman, and Bowers is the poor relation.
Wrong, Mother, said Tim, grinning. He had suddenly recovered his good humour.
How do you know?
Because I was in the lounge before dinner, and the old bean said to the companion woman, Where's Miss Bowers?
Fetch her at once, Cornelia.
And away trotted Cornelia like an obedient dog.
I shall have to talk to Miss Van Schuyler, mused Mrs. Allerton.
Tim grinned again. She'll snub you, Mother.
Not at all. I shall pave the way by sitting near her and conversing in low, but penetrating, well-bred tones about any titled relations and friends I can remember. I think a casual mention of your second cousin once removed, the Duke of Glasgow, would probably do the trick.
How unscrupulous you are, Mother. Events after dinner were not without their amusing side to a student of human nature. The socialist young man, who turned out to be Mr. Ferguson as deduced, retired to the smoking room, scorning the assemblage of passengers in the observation saloon on the top deck. Miss Van Schuyler duly secured the best and most undrafty position there by advancing firmly on a table at which Mrs. Otterbourne was sitting, and saying,
You'll excuse me, I'm sure, but I think my knitting was left here.
Fixed by a hypnotic eye, the turban rose and gave ground. Miss Van Schuyler established herself and her suite. Mrs. Otterbourne sat down nearby and hazarded various remarks which were met with such chilling politeness that she soon gave up. Miss Van Schuyler then sat in glorious isolation. The Doyles sat with the Allertons. Dr. Bessner retained the quiet Mr. Fanthorpe as his companion. Jacqueline de Belfort sat by herself with a book. Rosalie Otterbourne was restless, and Mrs. Allerton spoke to her once or twice and tried to draw her into their group, but the girl responded ungraciously. Monsieur Hercule Poirot spent his evening listening to an account of Mrs. Otterbourne's mission as a writer. On his way to his cabin that night, he encountered Jacqueline de Belfort. She was leaning over the rail, and as she turned her head, he was struck by the look of acute misery on her face. There was now no insouciance, no malicious defiance, no dark, flaming triumph.
Good night, mademoiselle.
Good night, Monsieur Poirot.
She hesitated, then said,
You were surprised to find me here?
I was not so much surprised as sorry. Very sorry.
He spoke gravely.
You mean sorry for me?
That is what I meant. You have chosen, mademoiselle, the dangerous course. As we here in this boat have embarked on a journey, so you too have embarked on your own private journey. A journey on a swift-moving river between dangerous rocks and heading for who knows what currents of disaster.
Why do you say all this?
Because it is true. You have cut the bonds that moored you to safety. and I doubt now if you could turn back if you would.
She said very slowly,
That is true.
Then she flung her head back. Ah, well, one must follow one's star, wherever it leads.
Beware, mademoiselle, that it is not a false star.
She laughed and mimicked the parrot cry of the donkey boys.
That very bad star, sir. That star fall down.
He was just dropping off to sleep when the murmur of voices awoke him. It was Simon Doyle's voice he heard, repeating the same words he had used when the steamer left Shellal. We've got to go through with it now.
Yes, thought Hercule Poirot to himself. We have got to go through with it now.
He was not happy. Chapter 9. The steamer arrived early next morning at Es-Sabua. Cornelia Robson, her face beaming, a large flapping hat on her head, was one of the first to hurry on shore. Cornelia was not good at snubbing people. She was of an amiable disposition and disposed to like all her fellow creatures. The sight of Hercule Poirot in a white suit, pink shirt, large black bow tie, and a white topi did not make her wince as the aristocratic Miss Van Schuyler would assuredly have winced. As they walked together up an avenue of sphinxes, she responded readily to his conventional opening.
Your companions are not coming ashore to view the temple?
Well, you see, Cousin Marie, that's Miss Van Schuyler, never gets up very early. She has to be very, very careful of her health. And, of course, she wanted Miss Bowers, that's her hospital nurse, to do things for her. And she said, too, that this isn't one of the best temples, but she was frightfully kind and said it would be quite all right for me to come.
That was very gracious of her, said Poirot dryly.
The ingenuous Cornelia agreed unsuspectingly.
Oh, she's very kind. It's simply wonderful of her to bring me on this trip. I do feel I'm a lucky girl. I could just hardly believe it when she suggested to Mother that I should come too.
And you have enjoyed it, yes?
Oh, it's been wonderful. I've seen Italy, Venice and Padua and Pisa, and then Cairo. Only Cousin Marie wasn't very well in Cairo, so I couldn't get around much. And now this wonderful trip up the Wadi Halfa and back. Oh.
Poirot said, smiling,
You have the happy nature, mademoiselle.
He looked thoughtfully from her to the silent, frowning Rosalie, who was walking ahead by herself.
She's very nice-looking, isn't she?
Said Cornelia, following his glance.
Only kind of scornful-looking. She's very English, of course. She's not as lovely as Mrs. Doyle. Oh, I think Mrs. Doyle's the loveliest, the most elegant woman I've ever seen. And her husband just worships the ground she walks on, doesn't he? I think that grey-haired lady is kind of distinguished-looking, don't you? She's cousin to a duke, I believe. She was talking about him right near us last night, but she isn't actually titled herself, is she?
She prattled on until the dragoman in charge called a halt and began to intone.
This temple was dedicated to Egyptian god Amun and the sun god Re-Harakhte, whose symbol was hawk's head.
It droned on. Dr. Bessner, Baedeker in hand, mumbled to himself in German. He preferred the written word. Tim Allerton had not joined the party. His mother was breaking the ice with the reserved Mr. Fanthorpe. Andrew Pennington, his arm through Lynette Doyle's, was listening attentively, seemingly most interested in the measurements as recited by the guide.
65 feet high, is that so? Looks a little less to me.
Great fellow, this Rameses. An Egyptian live wire.
A big businessman, Uncle Andrew.
Andrew Pennington looked at her appreciatively.
You look fine this morning, Lynette. I've been a mite worried about you lately. You look kind of peaky.
Chatting together, the party returned to the boat. Once more, the Karnak glided up the river. The scenery was less stern now. There were palms, cultivation. It was as though the change in the scenery had relieved some secret oppression that had brooded over the passengers. Tim Allerton had got over his fit of moodiness. Rosalie looked less sulky. Lynette seemed almost light-hearted, and Pennington said to her,
It's tactless to talk business to a bride on her honeymoon, but there are just one or two things.
Why, of course, Uncle Andrew,
Lynette at once became businesslike.
My marriage has made a difference, of course.
Well, that's just it. Sometime or other I want your signature to several documents.
Well, why not now?
Andrew Pennington glanced round. Their corner of the observation saloon was quite untenanted. Most of the people were outside on the deck space between the observation saloon and the cabins. The only occupants of the saloon were Mr. Ferguson, who was drinking beer at a small table in the middle, his legs encased in their dirty flannel trousers, stuck out in front of him, whilst he whistled to himself in the intervals of drinking. Monsieur Poirot, who was sitting close up to the front glass, intent on the panorama unfolding before him, and Miss Van Schuyler, who was sitting in a corner reading a book on Egypt. "That's fine," said Andrew Pennington. He left the saloon. Lynette and Simon smiled at each other, a slow smile that took a few minutes to come to full fruition. He said, "All right, sweet?" "Yes, still all right. Funny how I'm not rattled any more." Simon said with deep conviction in his tone, "You're marvellous." Pennington came back. He brought with him a sheaf of closely written documents. "Oh, mercy," cried Lynette. "Have I got to sign all these?" Andrew Pennington was apologetic. "Well, it's tough on you, I know, but I'd just like to get your affairs put in proper shape. First of all, there's the lease of the Fifth Avenue property. Then there are the Western land concessions." He talked on, rustling and sorting the papers. Simon yawned. The door of the deck swung open, and Mr. Fanthorpe came in. He gazed aimlessly round, then strolled forward and stood by Poirot, looking out at the pale blue water and the yellow enveloping sands. "You sign just there," concluded Pennington, spreading a paper before Lynette and indicating a space. Lynette picked up the document and glanced through it. She turned back once to the first page, then, taking up the fountain pen Pennington had laid beside her, she signed her name, Lynette Doyle. Pennington took away the paper and spread out another. Fanthorpe wandered over in their direction. He peered out through the side window at something that seemed to interest him on the bank they were passing.
"That's just the transfer," said Pennington. "You needn't read it."
But Lynette took a brief glance through it. Pennington laid down a third paper. Again, Lynette perused it carefully.
"Well, they're all quite straightforward," said Andrew. "Nothing of interest, only legal phraseology."
Simon yawned again. "Oh, my dear girl, you're not going to read the whole lot through, are you? You'll be at it till lunchtime and longer." "No, I always read everything through," said Lynette. "Father taught me to do that. He said there might be some clerical error." Pennington laughed rather harshly.
"You're a grand woman of business, Lynette."
"Well, she's much more conscientious than I'd be," said Simon, laughing. "I've never read a legal document in my life. I sign where they tell me to sign on the dotted line, and that's that."
"Well, that's frightfully slipshod," said Lynette disprovingly.
"Well, I've no business head," said Simon cheerfully.
"Never had. A fellow tells me to sign, I sign. It's much the simplest way."
Andrew Pennington was looking at him thoughtfully. He said dryly, stroking his upper lip,
"Well, it's a little risky sometimes, Doyle."
"Oh, nonsense," said Simon.
"I'm not one of those people who believe the world is out to do one down. I'm a trusting kind of fellow, and it pays, you know. I've hardly ever been let down."
Suddenly, to everyone's surprise, the silent Mr. Fanthorpe swung round and addressed Lynette.
I hope I'm not butting in, but you must let me say how much I admire your businesslike capacity. In my profession, I'm a lawyer, I find ladies sadly unbusinesslike. Never to sign a document before you read it through is admirable. Altogether admirable."
He gave a little bow. Then, rather red in the face, he turned once more to contemplate the banks of the Nile. Lynette said rather uncertainly,
Thank you."
She bit her lip to repress a giggle. The young man had looked so preternaturally solemn. Andrew Pennington looked seriously annoyed. Simon Doyle looked uncertain whether to be annoyed or amused. The backs of Mr. Fanthorpe's ears were bright crimson.
"Next, please," said Lynette,
smiling up at Pennington.
But Pennington was looking decidedly ruffled. "I think perhaps some other time would be better," he said stiffly. "Doyle says, if you have to read through all these, we shall be here till lunchtime. We mustn't miss enjoying the scenery. Anyway, those first two papers were the only urgent ones. We'll settle down to business later."
Lynette said, "It's frightfully hot in here. Let's go outside." The three of them passed through the swing door. Hercule Poirot turned his head. His gaze rested thoughtfully on Mr. Fanthorpe's back. Then it shifted to the lounging figure of Mr. Ferguson, who had his head thrown back and was still whistling softly to himself. Finally, Poirot looked over at the upright figure of Miss Van Schuyler in her corner. Miss Van Schuyler was glaring at Mr. Ferguson. The swing door on the port side opened, and Cornelia Robson hurried in.
"You've been a long time," snapped the old lady. "Where have you been?"
Why, I'm so sorry, Cousin Marie. The will wasn't where you said it was. It was in another case altogether.
My dear child, you're perfectly hopeless at finding anything. You are willing, I know, my dear, but you must try to be a little cleverer and quicker. It only needs concentration.
Why, I'm so sorry, Cousin Marie. I'm afraid I'm very stupid.
Nobody need be stupid if they try, my dear. I've brought you on this trip, and I expect a little attention in return.
Cornelia flushed.
I'm very sorry, Cousin Marie.
And where is Miss Bowers? It was time for my drops 10 minutes ago. Please go and find her at once. The doctor said it was most important.
But at this stage, Miss Bowers entered carrying a small medicine glass.
Your drops, Miss Van Schuyler.
I should have had them at 11,
snapped the old lady.
If there's one thing I detest, it's unpunctuality.
Quite,
said Miss Bowers. She glanced at her wristwatch.
It's exactly 11:30.
Well, by my watch it's 10 past.
I think you'll find my watch is right. It's a perfect timekeeper. It never loses or gains.
Miss Bowers was quite imperturbable. Miss Van Schuyler swallowed the contents of the medicine glass.
I feel definitely worse,
she snapped.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Miss Van Schuyler.
Miss Bowers did not sound sorry. She sounded completely uninterested. She was obviously making the correct reply mechanically.
It's too hot in here,
snapped Miss Van Schuyler.
Find me a chair on the deck, Miss Bowers. Cornelia, bring me my knitting, and don't be clumsy or drop it, and then I shall want you to wind some wool.
The procession passed out. Mr. Ferguson sighed, stirred his legs, and remarked to the world at large,
Gosh! I'd like to scrag that dame.
Poirot asked interestedly.
She is a type you dislike, eh?
Dislike? I should say so. What good has that woman ever been to anyone or anything? She's never worked or lifted a finger. She's just battened on to other people. She's a parasite. A damned unpleasant parasite. There are a lot of people on this boat I'd say the world could do without.
Really?
Yes. That girl in here just now signing share transfers, throwing her weight about. Hundreds and thousands of wretched workers slaving for a mere pittance to keep her in silk stockings and useless luxuries. One of the richest women in England, so someone told me, and never done a hand's turn in her life.
Who told you she was one of the richest women in England?
Mr. Ferguson cast a belligerent eye at him.
A man you wouldn't be seen speaking to. A man who works with his hands and isn't ashamed of it. Not one of your dressed-up, foppish, good-for-nothings.
His eyes rested unfavourably on the bow tie and pink shirt.
Me? I work with my brains, and I'm not ashamed of it,
said Poirot, answering the glance. Mr. Ferguson merely snorted.
Ought to be shot up. The lot of them.
My dear young man, said Poirot, what a passion you have for violence.
Now can you tell me of any good that can be done without it? You've got to break down and destroy before you can build up.
It is certainly much easier and much noisier and much more spectacular.
Well, what do you do for a living? Nothing at all, I bet. Probably call yourself a middleman.
I am not a middleman. I am a top man,
said Hercule Poirot with slight arrogance.
Well, what are you?
I am a detective,
said Hercule Poirot with the modest air of one who says, I am a king.
Good God!
The young man seemed seriously taken aback.
Do you mean that girl actually totes about a dumb dick? Is she as careful of her precious skin as that?
I have no connection whatever with Mr. and Mrs. Doyle,
said Poirot stiffly.
I am on a holiday.
Well, enjoying a vacation, eh?
And you? Is it not that you are on a holiday also?
Holiday? What?
Mr. Ferguson snorted. Then he added cryptically,
I'm studying conditions.
Very interesting,
murmured Poirot, and moved gently out onto the deck. Miss Van Schuyler was established in the best corner. Cornelia knelt in front of her, her arms outstretched with a skein of grey wool upon them. Miss Bowers was sitting very upright, reading the Saturday Evening Post. Poirot wandered gently onward down the starboard deck. As he passed round the stern of the boat, he almost ran into a woman who turned a startled face towards him, a dark, piquant Latin face. She was neatly dressed in black and had been standing, talking to a big, burly man in uniform, one of the engineers, by the look of him. There was a queer expression on both their faces, guilt and alarm. Poirot wondered
what they had been talking about. He rounded the stern and continued his walk along the port side. A cabin door opened and Mrs. Otterbourne emerged and nearly fell into his arms. She was wearing a scarlet satin dressing gown.
"Oh, so sorry,"
she apologised.
"Dear Mr. Poirot, so very sorry. The motion, just the motion, you know. Never did have any sea legs. If the boat would only keep still..."
She clutched at his arm.
"It's the pitching I can't stand. Never really happy at sea, and left all alone here, hour after hour. That girl of mine, no sympathy, no understanding of a poor old mother who's done everything for her."
Mrs. Otterbourne began to weep.
"Slaved for her, I have. Worn myself to the bone. To the bone. A grand amoureuse. That's what I might have been. A grand amoureuse. Sacrificed everything, everything, and nobody cares. But I'll tell everyone, I'll tell them now, how she neglects me, how hard she is, making me come on this journey, bored to death. I'll go and tell them now."
She surged forward. Poirot gently repressed the action.
"I will send her to you, madame. Re-enter your cabin. It is best that way."
"No! I want to tell everyone on the boat!"
"It is too dangerous, madame. The sea is too rough. You might be swept overboard."
Mrs. Otterbourne looked at him doubtfully.
"You think so? You really think so?"
"I do."
He was successful. Mrs. Otterbourne wavered, faltered, and re-entered her cabin. Poirot's nostrils twitched once or twice. Then he nodded and walked on to where Rosalie Otterbourne was sitting between Mrs. Allerton and Tim.
"Your mother wants you, mademoiselle."
She had been laughing quite happily. Now her face clouded over. She shot a quick, suspicious look at him and hurried along the deck.
"I can't make that child out," said Mrs. Allerton. "She varies so. One day she's friendly, the next day she's positively rude."
"Thoroughly spoilt and bad-tempered," said Tim. Mrs. Allerton shook her head.
"No, I don't think it's that. I think she's unhappy."
Tim shrugged his shoulders.
"Oh, well, I suppose we've all got our private troubles."
His voice sounded hard and curt. A booming noise was heard.
"Lunch!" cried Mrs. Allerton delightedly. "I'm starving."
That evening, Poirot noticed that Mrs. Allerton was sitting talking to Miss Van Schuyler. As he passed, Mrs. Allerton closed one eye and opened it again. She was saying,
"Yes, of course, at Calfrey's castle, the dear Duke..."
Cornelia, released from her attendance, was out on the deck. She was listening to Dr. Bessner, who was instructing her somewhat ponderously in Egyptology, as culled from the pages of Baedeker. Cornelia listened with rapt attention. Leaning over the rail, Tim Allerton was saying, "Anyhow, it's a rotten world." Rosalie Otterbourne answered,
"It's unfair. Some people have everything."
Poirot sighed. He was glad that he was no longer young. Chapter 10. On the Monday morning, various expressions of delight and appreciation were heard on the deck of the Carnac. The steamer was moored to the bank, and a few hundred yards away, the morning sun just striking it, was a great temple carved out of the face of the rock. Four colossal figures, hewn out of the cliff, looked out eternally over the Nile and faced the rising sun. Cornelia Robson said incoherently,
"Oh, Monsieur Poirot, isn't it wonderful? I mean, they're so big and so peaceful. And looking at them makes one feel that one's so small and rather like an insect, and that nothing matters very much, really, does it?"
Mr. Fanthorpe, who was standing nearby, murmured,
Very impressive.
"Grand, isn't it?" said Simon Doyle, strolling up. He went on confidentially to Poirot,
"You know, I'm not much of a fellow for temples and sightseeing and all that, but a place like this sort of gets you, if you know what I mean. Those old pharaohs must have been wonderful fellows."
The others had drifted away. Simon lowered his voice.
"I'm no end glad we came on this trip. It's cleared things up. Amazing why it should, but there it is. Lynette's got her nerve back. She says it's because she's actually faced the business at last."
"I think that is very probable," said Poirot.
"She says that when she actually saw Jackie on the boat, she felt terrible, and then suddenly it didn't matter any more. We both agreed that we won't try and dodge her any more. We'll just meet her on her own ground and show her that this ridiculous stunt of hers doesn't worry us a bit. It's just damned bad form, that's all. She thought she'd get us badly rattled, but now, well, We just aren't rattled any more, and that ought to show her.
Yes,
said Poirot thoughtfully. So that's splendid, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Lynette came along the deck. She was dressed in a soft shade of apricot linen. She was smiling. She greeted Poirot with no particular enthusiasm, just gave him a cool nod and then drew her husband away. Poirot realized, with a momentary flicker of amusement, they'd not made himself popular by his critical attitude. Lynette was used to unqualified admiration of all she was or did. Hercule Poirot had sinned noticeably against this creed. Mrs. Allerton, joining him, murmured, "What a difference in that girl! She looked worried and not very happy at Aswan. Today she looked so happy that one might almost be afraid she was fey." Before Poirot could respond, as he meant, the party was called to order. The official dragoman took charge, and the party was led ashore to visit Abu Simbel. Poirot himself fell into step with Andrew Pennington.
"Is it your first visit to Egypt, yes?"
he asked. "Oh, I know. I was here in 1923. That is to say, I was in Cairo. I've never been this trip up the Nile before."
"You came over on the Karmanik, I believe. At least so Mrs. Doyle was telling me."
Pennington shot a shrewd glance in his direction.
"Oh, why, yes, that's so," he admitted.
"I wondered if you happened to come across some friends of mine who were on board, the Rushington Smiths."
"I can't recall anyone of that name, no. The boat was full, and we had bad weather. A lot of passengers hardly appeared, and in any case the voyage is so short one doesn't get to know who's on board and who isn't."
"Oh, yes, that is very true. What a pleasant surprise you're running into Mrs. Doyle and her husband, eh? You had no idea they were married?"
"Oh, no, no, no. Mrs. Doyle had written to me, but the letter was forwarded on, and I only received it some days after our unexpected meeting here in Cairo."
"You have known her for many years, I understand."
"Why, I should say I have, Monsieur Poirot. I've known Lynette Ridgway since she was just a cute little thing, so high."
He made an illustrating gesture.
"Her father and I were lifelong friends. Well, he was a very remarkable man, Mellowish Ridgway, and a very successful one."
"His daughter comes into a considerable fortune, I understand. Oh, pardon, perhaps it is not delicate what I say there."
Andrew Pennington seemed slightly amused. "Oh, no, that's pretty common knowledge. Yes, Lynette's a wealthy woman."
"I suppose, though, that the recent slump is bound to affect any stock, however sound it may be."
Pennington took a moment or two to answer. He said at last,
"Yeah, that, of course, is true to a certain extent. The position is very difficult in these days."
Poirot murmured,
"I should imagine, however, that Mrs. Doyle has a keen business head."
"Oh, that is so, yeah, that is so, yes. Lynette is a clever, practical girl."
They came to a halt. The guide proceeded to instruct them on the subject of the temple built by the great Rameses. The four colossi of Rameses himself, one pair on each side of the entrance, hewn out of the living rock, looked down on the straggling little party of tourists. Signor Ricchetti, disdaining the remarks of the dragoman, was busy examining the reliefs of Negro and Syrian captives on the bases of the colossi on either side of the entrance. When the party entered the temple, a sense of dimness and peace came over them. The still, vividly coloured reliefs on some of the inner walls were pointed out, but the party tended to break up into groups. Dr. Bessner read sonorously in German from a Baedeker, pausing every now and then to translate for the benefit of Cornelia, who walked in a docile manner beside him. This was not to continue, however. Miss Van Schuyler, entering on the arm of the phlegmatic Miss Bowers, uttered a commanding,
"Cornelia, come here!"
And the instruction had perforce to cease. Dr. Bessner beamed after her vaguely through his thick lenses.
"A very nice maiden, that," he announced to Poirot. "She does not look so starved as some of these young women. No, she has the nice curves. She listens, too, very intelligently. It is a pleasure to instruct her."
It fleeted across Poirot's mind that it seemed to be Cornelia's fate either to be bullied or instructed. In any case, she was always the listener, never the talker. Miss Bowers, momentarily released by the peremptory summons of Cornelia, was standing in the middle of the temple looking about her with her cool, incurious gaze. Her reaction to the wonders of the past was succinct. "The guide says the name of one of these gods or goddesses was Mut. Can you beat it?" There was an inner sanctuary where sat four figures eternally presiding, strangely dignified in their dim aloofness. Before them stood Lynette and her husband. Her arm was in his, her face lifted, a typical face of the new civilization, intelligent, curious, untouched by the past. Simon said suddenly, Let's get out of here. I don't like these four fellows, especially the one in the high hat.
That's Amon, I suppose. And that one is Rameses. Why don't you like them? I think they're very impressive.
They're a damn sight too impressive. There's something uncanny about them.
Come out into the sunlight.
Lynette laughed, but yielded.
They came out of the temple into the sunshine with the sand yellow and warm about their feet. Lynette began to laugh. At their feet, in a row, presenting a momentarily gruesome appearance as though sawn from their bodies, were the heads of half a dozen Nubian boys. Their eyes rolled. The heads moved rhythmically from side to side. The lips chanted a new invocation.
Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Very good, very nice, thank you very much!
How absurd! How do they do it? Are they really buried very deep?
Simon produced some small change.
Very good, very nice, very expensive, he mimicked.
Two small boys in charge of the show picked up the coins neatly. Lynette and Simon passed on. They had no wish to return to the boat, and they were weary of sightseeing. They settled themselves with their backs to the cliff and let the warm sun bake them through.
How lovely the sun is, thought Lynette. How warm, how safe. How lovely it is to be happy. How lovely to be me. 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 Lynette.
Her eyes closed. She was half asleep, half awake, drifting in the midst of thought that was like the sand drifting and blowing. Simon's eyes were open. They too held contentment. What a fool he'd been to be rattled that first night.
There was nothing to be rattled about. Everything was all right. After all, one could trust Jackie.
There was a shout. Someone running towards him, waving their arms, shouting. Simon stared stupidly for a moment, then he sprang to his feet and dragged Lynette with him. Not a minute too soon. A big boulder hurtling down the cliff crashed past them. If Lynette had remained where she was, she would have been crushed to atoms. White-faced, they clung together. Hercule Poirot and Tim Allerton ran up to them.
Oh, ma foi, madame, that was a near thing.
All four instinctively looked up at the cliff. There was nothing to be seen. But there was a path along the top. Poirot remembered seeing some natives walking along there when they had first come ashore. He looked at the husband and wife. Lynette looked dazed still, bewildered. Simon, however, was inarticulate with rage.
God damn her!
He ejaculated. He checked himself with a quick glance at Tim Allerton. The latter said,
Phew, that was near. Did some fool bowl that thing over, or did it get detached on its own?
Lynette was very pale. She said with difficulty,
I think some fool must have done it. Well, might have crushed you like an eggshell. Sure you haven't got an enemy, Lynette?
Lynette swallowed twice and found difficulty in answering the light-hearted raillery. Poirot said quickly,
Come back to the boat, madame. You must have a restorative.
They walked there silently, Simon still full of pent-up rage. Tim trying to talk cheerfully and distract Lynette's mind from the danger she had run. Poirot with a grave face. And then, just as they reached the gangplank, Simon stopped dead. A look of amazement spread over his face. Jacqueline de Belfort was just coming ashore. Dressed in blue gingham, she looked childish this morning.
Good God, said Simon under his breath. So it was an accident after all.
The anger went out of his face. An overwhelming relief showed so plainly that Jacqueline noticed something amiss.
Good morning, she said. I'm afraid I'm a little on the late side.
She gave them all a nod and stepped ashore and proceeded in the direction of the temple. Simon clutched Poirot's arm. The other two had gone on.
My God, that's a relief. I thought...
Poirot nodded.
Yes, yes, I know what you thought.
But he himself still looked grave and preoccupied. He turned his head and noted carefully what had become of the rest of the party from the ship. Miss Van Schuyler was slowly returning on the arm of Miss Bowers. A little farther away, Mrs. Allerton was standing, laughing at the little Nubian row of heads. Mrs. Otterbourne was with her. The others were nowhere in sight. Poirot shook his head as he followed Simon slowly onto the boat.
Chapter 11
Will you explain to me, madame, the meaning of the word fée?
Mrs. Allerton looked slightly surprised. She and Poirot were toiling slowly up to the rock, overlooking the second cataract. Most of the others had gone up on camels, but Poirot had felt that the motion of the camel was slightly reminiscent of that of a ship. Mrs. Allerton had put it, on the grounds of personal dignity. They had arrived at Wadi Halfa the night before. This morning, two launches had conveyed all the party to the second cataract, with the exception of Signor Ricchetti, who had insisted on making an excursion of his own to a remote spot called Semna, which he explained was of paramount interest as being the gateway of Nubia in the time of Amenemhat III, and where there was a steel recording the fact that on entering Egypt Negroes must pay custom duties. Everything had been done to discourage this example of individuality, but with no avail. Signor Ricchetti was determined and had waved aside each objection. One, that the expedition was not worth making, and two, that the expedition could not be made owing to the impossibility of getting a car there, three, that no car could be obtained to do the trip, four, that a car would be a prohibitive price. Having scoffed at one, expressed incredulity at two, offered to find a car himself to three, and bargained fluently in Arabic for four, Signor Ricchetti had at last departed, his departure being arranged in a secret and furtive manner in case some of the other tourists should take it into their heads to stray from the appointed paths of sightseeing. "Fay," Mrs. Allerton put her head on one side as she considered her reply. "Well, it's a Scotch word, really. It means the kind of exalted happiness that comes before disaster. You know, it's too good to be true." She enlarged on the theme. Poirot listened attentively.
"I thank you, madame. I understand now. It is odd that you should have said that yesterday, when Madame Doyle was to escape death so shortly afterwards."
Mrs. Allerton gave a little shiver.
"It must have been a very near escape. Do you think some of those little black wretches rolled that stone over for fun? It's the sort of thing boys might do all over the world, not perhaps really meaning any harm."
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"It may be, madame."
He changed the subject, talking of Mallorca and asking various practical questions from the point of view of a possible visit. Mrs. Allerton had grown to like the little man very much, partly, perhaps, out of a contradictory spirit. Tim, she felt, was always trying to make her less friendly to Hercule Poirot, whom he had summarized firmly as the worst kind of bounder. But she herself did not call him a bounder. She supposed it was his somewhat foreign exotic clothing which aroused her son's prejudices. She herself found him an intelligent and stimulating companion. He was also extremely sympathetic. She found herself suddenly confiding in him her dislike of Joanna Southwood. It eased her to talk of the matter, and after all, why not? He did not know Joanna, would probably never meet her. Why should she not ease herself of that constantly borne burden of jealous thought? At the same moment, Tim and Rosalie Otterbourne were talking of her. Tim had just been half-jestingly abusing his luck. His rotten health, never bad enough to be really interesting, yet not good enough for him to have led the life he would have chosen. Very little money, no congenial occupation. "A thoroughly lukewarm, tame existence," he finished discontentedly. Rosalie said abruptly,
"You've got something heaps of people would envy you."
"What's that?"
"Your mother."
Tim was surprised and pleased.
"Mother? Oh, yes, of course, she is quite unique. It's nice of you to see it." "I think she's marvellous. She looks so lovely, so composed and calm, as though nothing could ever touch her. And yet somehow she's always ready to be funny about things, too."
Rosalie was stammering slightly in her earnestness. Tim felt a rising warmth towards the girl. He wished he could return the compliment, but lamentably Mrs. Otterbourne was his idea of the world's greatest menace. The inability to respond in kind made him embarrassed. Miss Van Schuyler had stayed in the launch. She could neither risk the ascent on a camel nor on her legs. She had said snappily,
"I'm sorry to have to ask you to stay with me, Miss Bowers. I intended you to go and Cornelia to stay, but girls are so selfish. She rushed off without a word to me. And I actually saw her talking to that very unpleasant and ill-bred young man, Ferguson. Cornelia has disappointed me sadly. She has absolutely no social sense."
Miss Bowers replied in her usual matter-of-fact fashion.
"Oh, that's quite all right, Miss Van Schuyler. It would have been a hot walk up there, and I don't fancy the look of those saddles on the camels. Fleas, as likely as not."
She adjusted her glasses, screwed up her eyes to look at the party descending the hill, and remarked,
"Miss Robson isn't with that young man anymore. She's with Dr. Bessner."
Miss Van Schuyler grunted. Since she had discovered that Dr. Bessner had a large clinic in Czechoslovakia and a European reputation as a fashionable physician, she was disposed to be gracious to him. Besides, she might need his professional services before the journey was over. When the party returned to the Karnak, Lynette gave a cry of surprise.
"Oh, a telegram for me."
She snatched it off the board and tore it open.
Why, I don't understand. Potatoes? Beetroots? What does it mean, Simon?
Simon was just coming to look over her shoulder when a furious voice said, "Excuse me, that telegram is for me." And Signor Ricchetti snatched it rudely from her hand, fixing her with a furious glare as he did so.